It was the night of 20th of January 1923, and Thomas Hughes from Boggan Fen, County Roscommon, was about to write a letter to his mother. The letter would be sent from Costume Barracks at Lone, where Hughes was being held as a prisoner of the National Army. Earlier that evening, Hughes, a member of the anti-treaty IRA, had been informed that he, along with four comrades, was to be executed on the following morning.
"My darling mother, it is now 6 p.m. We are just after being told that we are to be executed in the morning at 8 o'clock. Do not fret for me. As with God's holy will, I will be prepared to meet him, as it is a grand thing to get timely warning before you die. I hope I will be in heaven before you receive this sad greeting. Well, welcome be the will of God. Remember, mother, if it is the will of God that he receives me, I will be always watching over yourself, Dad, Dotty, Pearl, Maud, Eileen, Jim, and Josie. Try and bear up, mother, and please God, we will all be together again in the time to come. I am writing to Grandma and some of my friends. My companions and I do not bear any malice against those who are going to carry out the deed. Goodbye for the present. Your loving son, Tom."
The story of those executions is one of four we will explore in this documentary, each of which looks at an aspect of the Civil War in the Midlands. We will discuss a fatal ambush in Glasson in August 1922, the shooting of an unarmed prisoner in Athlone 2 months later, the Civil War activities of Aliskinnell, and we will end with the official state-sanctioned executions that occurred in places such as Costume Barracks. But, to begin, and so as to better understand the background of the conflict, I spoke with Moat-based historian Dr. John Gibney of the Royal Irish Academy. John explains the aftermath of the Anglo-Irish Treaty.
Well, the split that ultimately led to the Civil War has its origins in the terms of the Anglo-Irish Treaty signed in December 1921, and most especially over the fact that the treaty established Ireland as not a republic, but a dominion within the British Commonwealth. Now, that was the main point of division. Not so much partition. People often assume partition was the main issue that divided people over the treaty. But the treaty had proposals for a boundary commission that many Republicans felt could address that issue down the line. So the pressing problem for them, and the issue that many Republicans found hard to swallow, was the fact that the Irish Free State would be within the British Empire, within the British Commonwealth. Its parliamentarians would have to swear an oath of fidelity to the monarch, often called an oath of allegiance. And this is just a little bit too much of a compromise for a lot of Republicans who had fought for an independent republic to accept. So on that basis, that key basis of principle, the independence movement split into pro and anti-treaty factions in January 1922. Now, the Dáils split over the treaty on the 7th of December, but a week later, under the terms of the treaty, a provisional government was appointed by the pro-treaty faction. This was to be headed by Michael Collins, and the provisional government was the transitional authority that was going to oversee the transition from British rule to Irish rule in the months before the Free State officially came into existence in December 1922, exactly a year after the treaty was signed. Now, the provisional government was it was based in Dublin City Hall. It officially took power or assumed authority on the 16th of January 1922 in a very brief and low-key ceremony in Dublin Castle. And it had responsibility for, I suppose, taking over the administration of Ireland, the various branches of the Irish government and administration that had existed under the British regime. And alongside this, even as the British were transferring control of their civil government in Ireland over to the new provisional government, they were withdrawing their forces quite rapidly from the island of Ireland. Okay, throughout, from January onwards, throughout February, March, and up until May, the very large British garrison was withdrawn from first Connacht and across the Midlands, and gradually brought back to the coasts in Munster and Leinster, grouped together in places like Cork and Dacora before their final departures from Ireland in May 1922. Now, that begs the question of, if the British military was going, what was going to replace it? And that brings us back to, I suppose, another element, and probably the most important element of the independence movement, which was the IRA itself. Because the divisions of the treaty were mirrored, not just in Sinn Féin, but also in the IRA, and in fact were probably more stark within the IRA, where probably a higher proportion of active IRA members opposed the treaty than did support it.
With the Dáil and Sinn Féin split over the treaty, the new provisional government moved to establish an army from the pro-treaty section of the IRA. Dr. John Gibney explains the split in the IRA and the drift towards open conflict.
There was a definite reluctance on the part of the IRA leadership to let these divisions spill out into the open. So the question of taking sides for the treaty was fudged for a few months. in, say, January, February, March, as British troops left their barracks and installations across Ireland, they were often handed over to whatever IRA unit was in the locality, whether it was pro or anti-treaty. So the IRA stayed broadly intact, you might say, but from the end of January, an explicitly pro-treaty military force began to come into being. Initially, I suppose, beginning with the Dublin Guard of the IRA, men who were very, very loyal to Michael Collins and followed his lead. They would have taken over Beggars Bush Barracks at the end of January 1922, which is the first, one of the first major barracks to be taken over. And then throughout February and into March, this kind of newer pro-treaty force began to come into being. Now, this pro-treaty force was still called the IRA. When Free State forces took over Victoria Barracks, later Custine Barracks in Athlone, and there's those famous photographs of uniformed uniformed Free State soldiers marching across the bridge in Athlone, they weren't called the National Army, which is the name the Free State Army was later known as. They were still called the IRA. And the split in the IRA, now I should say the new Free State forces were being supplied and equipped by the British government. They were being paid a salary. They weren't volunteers like the IRA necessarily, though many in the IRA were moving into this new pro-treaty force. But it wasn't until the end of March 1922, and the 26th of March, when there was an IRA convention, long delayed and finally held in Dublin's Mansion House, that the split in the IRA explicitly came out into the open, and you began to have factions of the IRA and units in the IRA explicitly repudiate, you might say, any authority the provisional government had and restate their allegiance to the Republic. I mentioned that law a moment ago. After that, the IRA convention, Sean McGowan, who had authority in and around Athlone, purged a lot of anti-treaty officers from the IRA garrison, the IRA units in the town and its locality. So there were attempts to kind of keep a lid on the split. And even after that split came into the open, there were attempts to avoid conflict. Like the IRA split three ways, not just two ways. One segment became the pro-treaty military, later called the National Army. One segment would soon occupy the forecourts in Dublin, and probably the most militant of the lot, who proclaimed a pretty unyielding allegiance to the Republic. But a much larger faction of the anti-treaty IRA, mainly based in Cork and mainly under the leadership of Liam Lynch, were actively trying to seek some kind of compromise with their former colleagues who were now taking one side against them. Even those IRA members who went against the treaty, it didn't necessarily mean they wanted to go to war with their colleagues. And up until the eve of the election that took place in June 1922, there were still attempts between the pro- and anti-treaty IRAs, or the Free State military and the anti-treaty IRA, to reach some kind of compromise that would head off the prospect of civil war. Now, in the background, you have to remember, the British were a key factor in all of this. They were overseeing this transition of power. There were limits to what they would concede, and they made it very clear that, you know, any compromise that breached the terms of the treaty as they saw it would lead to a renewed conflict, that they would wage war once again. And so ultimately, against that backdrop, it proved impossible for the two sides to bridge the divisions that had emerged between them since January.
The early weeks of the conflict are often referred to as the conventional phase of the Civil War, as both the forces of the Provisional Government and the anti-treaty IRA engaged in large-scale confrontations. By late summer 1922, the Provisional Government's forces, the National Army, had established government control of nearly all urban areas. In response, the anti-treaty IRA leadership decided in mid-August to reorganise its forces into small, active service units, which would engage in hit-and-run attacks against the National Army. One such attack took place in Glasson, near Athlone, in August 1922. At about 10:40 a.m. on Friday the 25th of August 1922, a Ford motor car left Custine Barracks at Lone for Longford. It contained four members of the National Army, Captain Carl, Captain Rattigan, Lieutenant Sean McCormack, and a soldier named Alfred Hayes, who was the driver. McCormack sat in the front passenger seat alongside Hayes, while Carl and Rattigan occupied the back seat. All of them were dressed in plain clothes and only two carried weapons, Carl and Rattigan, who had revolvers. By travelling in plain clothes, the soldiers, according to testimony at a subsequent inquest, hoped to avoid drawing the attention of their anti-treaty IRA enemy. Only 3 days earlier, Michael Collins had been killed when his small convoy was attacked by the anti-treaty IRA at Ballinabloh in West Cork. On that August morning, one of those units was waiting on the Athlone side of Glasson, ready to ambush any National Army forces who passed their position. The bulk of the unit was hidden behind the village's schoolhouse wall, directly opposite the old Royal Irish Constabulary barracks, with the others hidden behind a high wall on the far side of the road. Although newspapers later reported that the anti-treaty IRA unit contained 30 men, evidence presented at a subsequent inquest suggests that the actual figure may have been smaller, perhaps 20 men. Approaching them was the motor car containing Carl, Rattigan, McCormick and Hayes. It was travelling along the Low Road, which, as explained to me by historian Dr. Angus O'Finnigan, was the main road from Ballycairn to Glasson via Wineport until the late 1970s. Their journey was uneventful until, after turning the corner at Deer Park, they could see carts carrying loads of hay, five in total, approaching from Glasson. To gain a better understanding of what occurred, I visited Deer Park in the company of Dr. Angus Finnegan, who lives in the vicinity.
So we're standing here at a very sharp bend in the road, on the Low Road, about 400 yards, the Ballycairn side of Glasson. This was described as the Deer Park Corner, which is the name of the townland, in contemporary reports in 1922. You have a high stone wall. It's been lowered since, but at the time would have been about 8 foot high, but rising round behind it on one side of the road, and a very, very sharp bend. It's since been made a little bit less sharp, but it would have been 90 degrees or maybe more at the time. It's speculated that there might have been a scouting party here. Certainly would have been a good place for it anyway. With the high ground, they would have been able to see the lorry coming from the Ballycairn or Athlone direction from a considerable distance, and it would have been relatively easy to give a signal then to the ambush party who were up at the village at Glasson itself, at the schoolhouse, there was a direct line of sight from this corner, and still is today, up to the schoolhouse, about 400 yards of a dead straight road. And the bend is so severe that, you know, they could easily have put somebody on the glass inside the bend who could have given a signal, raised a flag or a hand or whatever, to let the ambush party know that the cars were coming.
As described by Angus, the road is bookended by two sharp corners. According to contemporary reports, the road narrowed just outside Glasson and the National Army car had to slow down as it moved past the carts. It was now, at the schoolhouse in Glasson, that the ambush began. The location is described by Angus O'Finnigan.
Yeah, so we're standing here at the old schoolhouse in Glasson, and this is the ambush site. And again, you have a very tight bend where the Low Road joins the present N55, our main road from Athlone to Ballymahon. And right at the corner there, you have the old RIC barracks, or was the RIC barracks, which had actually been burnt out during the War of Independence. So we could speculate as to whether the IRA party were located within the burnt out barracks, or behind the low stone wall which surrounds the schoolhouse across the road. Or perhaps they may even have had positions on what is known as the High Road locally, which at that time wasn't the main road, it was a small back road. And they probably could have taken up positions there without being disturbed too much by traffic at the time. And behind them then lay the Waterstown Estate Wall, which was again another high stone wall, 8 foot high. And they could easily have staked out the location there for a good number of hours or even days without being disturbed, because there's no houses in any of the land inside that wall. It was part of the Waterstown Estate. And actually, this kind of low ground there and a certain amount of trees and so on, it would have been probably a good place to stake out the location.
As explained by Angus, the anti-treaty IRA had chosen an excellent location from which to ambush their National Army enemy. What happened next was described in contemporary eyewitness accounts.
As the car moved between the fourth and fifth loads of hay at the corner by the old RIC barracks, the anti-treaty unit fired at least two shots, narrowly missing a young boy who was leading one of the cart horses. The occupants of the car ducked as it made the turn into Glasson. At that moment, a further volley rang out from behind the loopholed wall opposite the barrack corner. Carroll and Rattigan returned fire, two shots by Carroll and three by Rattigan. After the car had turned the corner and travelled about 20 metres into Glasson, Lieutenant Sean McCormick stood up, turned to his comrades and called out, "I am wounded." Carroll pushed McCormick back into his seat and shouted at Hayes to continue driving. According to an eyewitness named Mary Kilduff, the ambushers followed the car as it moved through Glasson, shooting as they went. At some point during the gunfire, a woman named Boyd, who had been startled by the shots, rushed outside onto the street where one of her children was lying in a pram. She was hit in the breast and muscle of the left arm. Two other people, also civilians, were hit by gunfire. Patrick Murta was sitting in a horse and cart talking to John McCormick, who was standing on the road. McCormick was shot in the leg, while a bullet entered the right side of Murta's torso. At the Tuberclare side of the village, the National Army car suddenly slowed down as it reached a rise in the road. Carroll again ordered Hayes to increase speed, but he replied, "I am not able. I am wounded." A few moments later, the car came to a stop and both Carroll and Rattigan jumped out of the vehicle. They attempted to help Hayes and McCormick, but they could see that their pursuers were gaining ground. By this stage, Kilduff had retreated to her home, but she heard one of the ambushers shout, "Put your hands up if you value your life." That shout was followed by a volley of gunfire, probably aimed at Carol and Rattigan, who fled into a local field. They later claimed that they were under constant fire from the ambushers, who pursued them for about 1 mile and a half. Both men escaped without injury.
The anti-treaty unit then split into smaller groups. One group brought Murta, who was still conscious, to a local dispensary run by a doctor named Glancy. They must have realised the seriousness of Murta's wounds, since they had also asked the doctor to send for a priest. Glancy sent one of his staff, a man named Moran, who returned to the office within a short time. Moran claimed that an armed man had blocked his route to the priest's house. A woman named Berry, perhaps another member of Glancy's staff, took on the task. She was successful and the priest arrived minutes later. Murta died after receiving the last rites. A short distance away, locals could see the burning wreck of the motor car which had been set on fire by one of the anti-treaty IRA groups. Before burning the car, they lifted McCormick, who may already have died from his wounds, and Hayes, who was incapacitated, out of the vehicle. The ambush was over. When news of the ambush reached Athlone, a contingent of the National Army departed Custine Barracks for Glasson. On the way, they encountered officers Carol and Rattigan, who had found refuge in a local home. At the village, they found Lieutenant Sean McCormick lying dead by the side of the road and discovered that the civilian Patrick Murta had died in Dr. Glancy's dispensary. Both bodies and the grievously wounded National Army soldier Albert Hayes were taken in a military ambulance to Athlone. In total, 5 people had been shot. Mrs. Boyd and John McCormick, both civilians, were lucky to have received relatively minor wounds. Lieutenant Sean McCormick, who was from Moat, had received a bullet wound to his left shoulder from which he bled to death. He was 16 years old. Murta, a 42-year-old egg dealer from Wineport, had also died from loss of blood. Albert Hayes from Tullamore, and aged about 20, remained alive, but his wounds would prove fatal. According to Dr. Glancy, Hayes had been shot in the back. The spinal cord was affected and his legs were paralysed. Within days of the ambush, Hayes died of an infection related to his wounds. Given the circumstances of the ambush, in which only a few shots were fired by the National Army soldiers, it is likely that all of those who were wounded and killed were struck by bullets fired by the anti-treaty IRA. McCormick's death was the subject of sermons in the locality. In the Midlands, the media gave prominence to the opinions of Athlone-born Michael Curley, recently installed as Archbishop of Baltimore in the United States. Curley, on a visit to Ireland at the time, gave a sermon in St. Mary's Church at Lone, whose contents were reported in local newspapers.
"I am not here from faraway land to enter into your domestic disputes, but I was born and raised amongst you, and I have never lost my love for my native land. I am interested in the welfare of Ireland. I am leaving you in a few days, horrified, well nigh stupefied with the picture presented to me. In the past few years, young Irishmen fought and died for the liberty of Ireland, and they were fighting against a foreign foe who never had and never will have the right to set foot on Ireland. The young men who suffered death and made the supreme sacrifice for Ireland in those days died honourably and well. But today, what have you? We are presented to the world now with the foreign foe gone from our shore and our own country in a large measure in our own hands, with the shaping of our own destinies and the education of our children as Irish children, no longer as little English children. We are going through a crucial time, a great test. And if I know anything about the noble Irish people today in Ireland, I know and I believe you are with me in knowing that you want peace. Yet, behind our hedges and in our ditches are the young men of Ireland lying in wait to murder, not a foreign foe, but their own brothers. Are they going to advance the cause of Ireland and bring liberty to Ireland by a campaign of destruction that is a scandal to the world and that is ruining this little land? Are they going to disgrace Ireland before the nations of the world by their present campaign, which is a campaign against the people, a campaign against the National Army, a campaign by a small minority that would have their will imposed on the majority and make us think they want nothing? There is no constructive program happening in Ireland. How can we explain the psychology of the men who murdered that little boy McCormack in Glasson and shot him dead in the village street? How can we explain, and how can I go back to America and explain the taking away of Michael Collins? How can I do it? He escaped the guns of 150,000 black and tans and British military. And he is done to death, murdered, Ireland's splendid young hero. By whom? By Irishmen. By his own brothers. Is it any wonder that shame rests upon the greater Ireland beyond the sea?
Such sentiments were shared by bishops and senior clergy in Ireland who strongly supported the Anglo-Irish Treaty. As demonstrated by works such as Patrick Murray's Oracles of God, a large majority of priests also endorsed the treaty. The days after the ambush were also marked by the funerals of those who had been killed. Patrick Murta was buried in the grounds of Tubberclare Church. His funeral, according to the Offaly Independent, amply proved that the deceased was a favourite with all sections of the community. The paper also reported that, at the different masses on Sunday in Tubberclare, the clergy strongly denounced the ambush. Moat witnessed an equally large turnout for the funeral mass of Lieutenant Sean McCormack. The Westmead Independent reported that 2,000 people followed the hearse as it travelled to the family burial ground at Boher. Over a week after the ambush, the body of Albert Hayes was taken by train from Athlone to Tullamore, where local units of the National Army provided a guard of honour as the coffin was brought from the railway station to the Church of the Assumption. Hayes was buried in Clonmenge Cemetery. So it was that, in the same week in which Michael Collins was killed, three Midland families were left to mourn the latest casualties in a war whose outcome was yet unknown, but whose legacy was being shaped with every fatality. One such legacy emerged after the ambush. Before he died, Albert Hayes made a sworn statement in which he claimed to recognise one of the ambushers. He said, "I know a man in the party by his voice. He worked in Tullamore and I saw him in different places. His name was Thomas Berry." Hayes' statement was not accepted as evidence during the inquest because it was deemed to be too tenuous. Yet Hayes was correct in his belief that Berry was one of the anti-treaty IRA ambushers. Thomas Berry confirmed this fact in his later application for a military pension. Also, Berry claimed that he remained on the run until 1924 so as to avoid being the target of retribution from Hayes' family and McCormack's brother Joseph, who was a captain in the National Army. That brings us to the second of our four stories from the Civil War in the Midlands. When the Civil War began in June 1922, Athlone's Custium Barracks became an important base for the National Army. With Sean McKeown as the senior officer, it was from Custium Barracks that the Provisional Government sent forces into the west of Ireland to wage war against the anti-treaty IRA. Custium Barracks also became a major centre for anti-treaty IRA prisoners of war, and by October 1922, there were nearly 1,000 of them crammed into the barracks. Those prisoners made regular escape attempts, and it is part of local folklore that the prisoners dug tunnels under the barrack walls. A prisoner in the barracks at that time, a man named John Snee, later gave an account of those tunnels to Ivor O'Hanlon, a retired colonel in the Irish Defence Forces.
Snee said they had started a tunnel. He told me that the tunnel went as far as the top left-hand corner of the barracks, and it was aimed to tunnel under the boundary wall and escape that way. Now, I can't remember whether he said that was the plan or that's what we did. They didn't discover the tunnel at that stage, but apparently a vehicle that had been handed over to the Free State Army by the British on departure, or left behind by them, came in, crossed between Pump Square and the canteen, and somebody noticed an inundation in the road after the vehicle had passed. And they looked at it, then suddenly discovered this could be the tunnel. But there's no history as to how long that tunnel had been. I believe it might only have been 20, 30 yards or so from Pump Square.
A series of cages were built to hold a large number of prisoners, and there were constant complaints from those prisoners as to low quality food or even lack of food and mistreatment by National Army soldiers. The atmosphere was tense, and on the 6th of October 1922, a prisoner named Patrick Mulrennan from County Roscommon was shot dead by a National Army officer. According to accounts that appeared in anti-treaty publications such as Freedom, amongst others, Mulrennan was killed during an inspection of the prisoners by National Army troops led by Sean McKeown. One account by a prisoner named Peter Shortall claimed that an officer with McKeown fired into a group of prisoners, hitting Mulrennan.
The bullet pierced the side of a young man, Patrick Mulrennan, a native of Liscall, Ballyhadreen. As he was about to fall, he called out, "I'm shot," and grasped one of his comrades by the shoulders, pointing to his side where the bullet hit. On raising up his coat, blood was oozing through his shirt. Dr. Ferran, TD, East Mayo and Sligo, was by his side in a few minutes and did all that was possible. The poor lad was lying in the yard, not able to utter a word, his blood gushing freely from his wound onto the ground. While in that position, McKeown, pressing his fingers on the wound, and then all of a sudden turned round and said to the prisoners, "By God, some more of ye would need it too."
Another eyewitness to this event, prisoner John Snee, later passed his version of events to Ivor O'Hanlon.
He called to the barrack and passed in and asked to have a look around. And the military policeman called me and I went down. And he was a fine big man, white-haired. And he told me his name and he was here during the Civil War. So I proceeded to think that he could add a little bit of history to what I knew or other people knew. And I said we'd walk around and went from the main gate and passing Pump Square. He said, "I was there during the Civil War." And it turned out he was an internee. He was an IRA irregular. And he had been imprisoned there. He didn't tell me how long, or if he did, I forgot. Anyway, quite often there were snap inspections of the place where they were imprisoned. And in Pump Square, on the top story, there were stone steps leading up to the top, outside steps. And he told me that one of the snap inspections was the PAs went into the place and ordered all the prisoners out and told them to hurry up quick. And they came up at the top and the PAs were standing up at the top of these steps and they pushed a couple of the people down the steps who ran down out of control. Tony Lawler and General Sean McKeown were at the bottom of the steps. Lawler apparently thought that the prisoner were rushing at McKeown. He took out his revolver and shot the prisoner dead.
Shortall's account differs in detail from Snee's account as relayed by O'Hanlon. Also, there is no evidence for or against Shortall's account of McKeown's supposed treatment of Mulrennan after the shooting. More importantly, however, both accounts match in describing an army officer using a revolver to shoot the unarmed Mulrennan during a prisoner inspection. That officer was Anthony Lawler, a senior member of McKeown's command. McKeown later defended Lawler before an inquest at the Curragh, saying that the officer had first fired a warning shot before hitting the deceased. In this case, we can see the effects of the censorship regime in place at that time. Although the overwhelming majority of the press, both national and regional, supported the Anglo-Irish Treaty, the Provisional Government still felt it necessary to censor newspaper content, especially in cases where government forces were culpable. The death of Mulrennan would likely have remained a local and overlooked event except for the publication by the Anti-Treaty IRA of an extraordinary letter from Lawler to his mother. In this letter, which the Anti-Treaty IRA claimed to have intercepted shortly after the shooting, Lawler boasted of his marksmanship, stating that he had taken what he called a wonderful shot, although little skill is required to shoot a man locked in a cage. Lawler's letter also contained a chilling line that, "I don't believe in shooting as wholesale medicine, but a little is very useful." Its usefulness had been confirmed in his eyes by the fact that the prisoners in Custume Barracks, he claimed, became markedly quieter following the shooting of Mulrennan. Of course, not all the conflicts of the Civil War were fought with guns and bombs. Words and images were deployed in the battle for public opinion, both internationally and in Ireland. An important contribution to that battle was made by a married couple, Alice and Laurence Ginnell. Delvin's Laurence Ginnell was then one of Ireland's most famous politicians, while Alice, who was born near Mullingar, was a skilled activist and organiser for both Cumann na mBan and Sinn Féin. During 1922 and 1923, Alice kept a record of hers and Laurence's activities, a record which shines a light on her experiences of the conflict. Alice, like her husband, opposed the Anglo-Irish Treaty, a fact that she recorded in her diary.
"The more I think of these terms, the more I dislike them, and that it would now be time for Laurence to withdraw from public life, or at any rate not take the oath to the king. It is either that the delegates have been tricked, or the treaty was signed so that the Dáil could reject the terms, and that De Valera could recommend them to reject them."
At that time, the Ganels were in Buenos Aires, Argentina, where they had been sent by Dáil Éireann during the summer of 1921 to influence local opinion in support of Irish republicanism. That year and the previous years, however, were not easy for the couple. Lawrence had been imprisoned by the British Crown forces on multiple occasions, a sequence of events that damaged his health, and his condition deteriorated while they were in Argentina. During January 1922, Alice confided to her diary that she feared what lay ahead.
I had a talk with Mother Rita and told her I was thinking how dreadful it would be if Lawrence died in Argentina and had to go alone with the coffin to Ireland. A very lonely day in the hospital. Felt it was the last New Year's Day that Lawrence would see. All the nuns seemed to feel the same loneliness. Writing in my autograph book, Lawrence wished unclouded happiness under God's protection and guidance with my love and respect as long as I live. I wrote, I'm afraid of this new year that is coming in.
In early 1922, Lawrence Ganell notified Dáil Éireann of his intention to vote against ratification of the treaty. Soon after, the couple decided to return to Ireland. They sailed from Argentina in April 1922, reaching the port of Liverpool a few weeks later.
We arrived in Liverpool. My father met us as we were getting off the boat. Some people thought it would be a good idea if Lawrence would call a meeting of the leaders on both sides in the split to try to come to some arrangement to prevent its widening and to arrive at some way of working together. But Lawrence did not think that this would meet with any success.
From Liverpool, they sailed to Ireland. Lawrence Ganell would run as an anti-treaty Sinn Féin candidate in the forthcoming general election in the constituency of Longford Westmeath. As they travelled from Dublin to Westmeath in early May 1922, the Ganells could see that the country was on the verge of civil war.
As we were coming into Kinnegad, the road was blocked. The Free State troops were taking the barracks from the Republicans, fulfilling Lawrence's prophecy when the treaty was signed that the next thing would be a split in the volunteers. There was a great welcome for us at home, but Lawrence was not at all well.
That split led to the civil war that began in late June 1922. A few weeks later, Alice Ganell recorded an entry in her diary that gives a sense of the chaos then prevalent in the country. Everyone, especially public figures such as Lawrence Ganell, were now susceptible to threats and violence.
3 nights running, a man entered the house in Bray. The first night he stole some chickens. The next night he got £60 belonging to Lawrence. He said he had instructions from Captain Dorn of the Free State Army and gave a receipt for the money as having been taken for the Free State Army. Only that Miss O'Shea held his hand, he would have bashed Lawrence's head in. Lawrence sent a wire to Michael Collins about the matter, saying he was holding him responsible for the money and demanding effective protection. Captain Dorn called and said that the man, whom they had arrested, had only been enrolled 3 days and said it was reported that De Valera was staying in the house. As if that were excuse enough.
As the conflict intensified, well-known figures such as Cathal Brua were killed. Like the Ganells, Brua opposed the treaty and took part in the fighting that took place in Dublin after the shelling of the forecourts. He was fatally wounded by National Army soldiers in July 1922. During his funeral, Alice carried Brua's son Rory, who was then a young child.
We both went to Cathal Brua's funeral. I was very proud to be carrying little Rory. Lawrence said the funeral was the funeral of the Republic. The inscription on the wreath we ordered for Cathal Brua. For how can a man die better than facing fearful odds? With more respect and sympathy than words can express.
Ganell had won a seat in the June election with Alice as his election agent, but in September 1922, he was forcibly removed from the Dáil after repeatedly questioning the constitutional status of that assembly. Alice Ganell recorded what must have been a bitter moment.
Meeting of the Treaty Dáil. Lawrence was the only Republican who attended. Having asked if the assembly was a meeting of Dáil Éireann or of a partition parliament, he was forcibly ejected. Sean McCohan was the only Free Stater to get up and shake hands with him before he was put out.
In October 1922, Alice, motivated by a combination of financial difficulties and a desire to publicise the anti-treaty cause internationally, returned to the United States of America. She established an office on Madison Avenue, New York. Lawrence followed in December and became the anti-treaty representative in Washington. They were increasingly isolated figures, however, even amongst anti-treaty Republicans.
There is friction everywhere. All the Irish people in New York, Skellig, O'Doherty, Moylan, Mrs. Skeffington, seem to resent Lawrence Ganell with the exception of Mrs. McSweeney and Robert Briscoe. Then there is friction between the various Irish Americans and Irish American associations. To simplify it, perhaps too much, it may be said between the Clonagail and the American Association for the Recognition of the Irish Republic, between the other ladies and Mrs. McSweeney, that is on the anti-treaty side, to say nothing of the division between the Free Staters and the Republicans.
Although Laurence Ginnell remained an active, seemingly unrelenting character, his health seemed to fade with each passing week. By early 1923, he was spending much of his time in Washington while Alice worked in New York. The couple were apart when Alice heard the news.
Mr. McGarrity rang up to ask when I had heard from Laurence and to say he was not at all well. I said, there must be great rejoicing over that, at which Mr. McGarrity was shocked. I then said to him, Mr. McGarrity, you are far too intelligent a man not to know what has been going on. I also said that I intended to go down to Washington on the following Saturday. Then Mrs. Skeffington rang up and asked me to come over to see her as soon as possible, that the matter was urgent. I wondered what was up, that they had telephoned after such a long silence. Went to see Mrs. Skeffington, who tried to break the news gently that Laurence was dead. R.I.P. Laurence called to see the doctor that morning and, to save the Irish Republican money, walked from the doctor's house back to his hotel. He died almost immediately he got back.
The grieving Alice Ginnell brought her husband's body back to Ireland for burial, after which she recorded a short entry to her diary.
It was on the 1st of May that his body arrived in Dublin. It was brought to Whitefriars Street and after Mass, next day by motor, to Clonarney, Delvin, where, in a grave lined with moss and primroses, he was laid to rest among his fathers.
The 6 months preceding Laurence Ginnell's death were a particularly brutal period in Ireland. Over the winter of 1922, the government had instituted a series of official executions in an attempt to demoralise and defeat the anti-treaty IRA. The majority of the executions were carried out under the emergency powers adopted by the Dáil in late September 1922, which allowed for military courts. Death sentences could be issued for the possession of arms or for taking part in attacks on the National Army. Figures such as Erskine Childers were executed in late 1922, and in January 1923, Athlone's Costume Barracks was the site of the execution of Thomas Hughes, whose letter opened this documentary, and four of his anti-treaty IRA comrades. One of those comrades was Stephen Joyce from Galway, who wrote a letter to his sister on the eve of the executions.
Dear Sister Julia, just a few lines bidding you the last farewell on tomorrow morning. Myself, Michael Walsh, Martin Burke, Herbert Collins, Thomas Hughes, will meet our death at the hands of Irishmen. Still, we are quite happy and contented. We have been to see a priest. We will hear Mass in the morning and receive the body and blood of our Saviour tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. It will be the happiest hour of my life. I know this will come as a terrible shock to you. I fear your heart will break. I ask you not to grieve for me, for it must be God's holy will that I should sacrifice my life for Ireland. It has been the dreams of my earliest youth. The music of the rifles have always been ringing in my ears. This I was destined to do. As you know the consequences, now tell mother and father not to grieve for me, for all I ask now is to pray for me. I would not like to hear ye crying when I am among the dead. Tell all my companions to pray for me, Julia. I ask you to wear those medals in memory of your dead brother. God bless and protect you from all danger. Goodbye now until I see you in heaven. From your loving brother, Stephen.
In Athlone, the execution spawned many local stories. One remarkable example comes from Joseph Flynn, a resident of the town whose father Martin was a soldier in the National Army during the Civil War. Martin Flynn served with a fellow soldier named Thomas Johnston, both of whom, according to a tradition within those families, were detailed to the execution unit in Costume Barracks in January 1923. Here, Joseph Flynn describes the story that he first heard while growing up in Athlone.
And anyway, seemingly what happened then, that it came to a stage that the IRA were causing a lot of havoc. And whoever deemed, I don't know who it was, Collins or who we're talking about, that go out and round up as much of the IRA as possible. Right? So, At that time, as I said, my father was in the barracks. And to cut this back and to try and make clarity over, I think there was five or six people, according to my father, who were brought into the jail. Seemingly, they were to be executed on the morning. Now, he was with a guy called Tommy Johnson, who was also in the First World War. My father was in the First World War, and he was in the Leinsters, if anybody out there wants to recap on that. And so they said they took a walk over, they said, and I don't know whether it was in the chapel or the little room, and they could see five or six men. And they noticed that some of them were quite elderly as well. Either my father said to Tommy, or Tommy said to my father, Martin or Tommy, one of them said, look down there, he said, Martin, he said. That was my father. He said, we're here now, he said, and look who we're going to shoot tomorrow. We're after coming back from the front. He said, we're back in the First World War, he said, and we were in the barracks, here we are now, right? He said, we are asked to kill Irish. And that's it. It's as simple as tomorrow morning. And we spent the last 3 or 4 years out in the front trying to kill Germans and all. And I don't know who said to what, but it was agreed anyway that they would not. They had to do, they knew that they were picked for the firing squad. They were picked for that. So on the following morning, they did. They fell in and with the rifles. And they walked in. So at that stage, they had it pre-arranged. At the command, I'd make it easier for people to understand, it was a 1-2, and it was a step back, or else ready to shoot. So when they got this, Tommy Johnson and my father stepped back. And at that stage, the firing stopped, because my father and Tommy Johnson were taken and were brought off into the clink. And the execution still went ahead, so it did. But there was hell to do in Athlone. I was told this after, but strange enough, it was. Now, I'm 91 at the moment, so I did know a lot of kind of elderly people. And they say, young friend, he said, your father did this and all, you know what I mean? So it did cause a lot of uproar in Athlone. My father, you see, seemingly my father and Tommy Johnson committed treason. It could be an act of treason, you know, but that'd be too much to swallow. And it would have been hell to do in Athlone if that happened. So I was told what they call it, that they were demobbed ignominiously, but I don't think that's correct, folks. But anyway, they got out. And basically, that's the short story, and I hope you can understand some of it.
Such executions took place in many locations around Ireland, including in Birr, Mullingar, Portlaoise and Rasscrea. The policy caused immense controversy at the time, even among supporters of the government. A sense of that controversy can be gained from accounts of the ceremonies that took place in late October 1924, during which the remains of those executed during the Civil War were returned to their families. In Athlone, Major General Sean McKeown presided over a ceremony witnessed by a journalist with the Westmeath Independent.
Notwithstanding the inclemency of the weather, a drenching downpour continuing from early morning, a large crowd had collected in the square or marketplace opposite the west gate of Custume Barracks. Many of the spectators were women and girls. Shortly after 11 o'clock, about 20 motor vehicles and a motor hearse arrived and were lined up from Market Square along the bridge to Custume Place. A few minutes before 12 o'clock, a Guard of Honour of IRA arrived and was formed up in double line facing the entrance gate to the barracks. Some time later, two soldiers carrying rifles with bayonets fixed at the slope emerged from the barracks and arrested a young man named Bernard Mulvihill, who appeared to be in charge of the Republican Guard of Honour. He was conveyed into the barracks between the two soldiers, and as he passed in through the gates, a little cheer went up from the bystanders. The young man acknowledged the cheer by taking off his hat, after which there were shouts of, "Up the Republic!" Four other young men were arrested during the day. All five, who were searched for arms, were subsequently set at liberty, no arms having been found on them.
Those scenes were replicated at other locations around Ireland. Perhaps they bought the families of those who were executed a moment of relative peace. For the country, they signified that while the Civil War was over, its legacy would endure. Rex Wreckage and Ruins, Scenes from a Civil War was researched, written and narrated by Ian Kennelly, historian in residence with Westmead County Council. Voice acting was provided by John McGlynn and Nicola O'Sullivan. This project is funded by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sports and Media's Decade of Centenaries programme in partnership with Westmead County Council.